I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise, he did the
mash. Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Gigi Little, editor of the new collection of short fiction, City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales. The tales in City of Weird, all set in a Portland both real and imagined, feature sea monsters, aliens, vampires, demons, ghosts, robotic dogs, bloodthirsty congregants, man-eating vegetation, magical books, seductive video games, secret bookstore basements, miniature cities, and one iconic game show host. Gigi's own essays in short fiction have appeared in anthologies and literary magazines, including Portland Noir, Spent, and the Pacific Northwest Reader. She works as a marketing coordinator at Powell's Books and also as the graphic designer for the Portland-based indie publisher Forest Avenue Press. Before all that, Gigi spent 15 years in the circus as a lighting director and professional clown. We're fortunate to have Gigi in the KBOO studios, along with three of the authors who contributed to City of Weird, Dan DeWeese, Karen Monroe, and Susie Vitello. Gigi, Dan, Karen, Susie, thanks for being here on KBOO.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gigi, we only have a half hour. There's so much to ask about the book, but I have to start with one perhaps unrelated question. You were a professional circus clown.
Yeah.
There's got to be a story there.
Oh, yeah, there is. I tend to go on for a long time, so how can I make it short? I married a clown, and I was in the circus for 15 years, from about 19 till 35-ish.
And then you came to Portland after the circus.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we probably should get to the book. We have to have you on later and talk about your circus days.
I don't have any evil clowns in the book.
That's right.
Nobody sent me any evil clown stories.
Okay.
Well, I never thought about that till just now.
Volume 2.
Yeah, Volume 2.
Let's get to City of Weird. How'd you come up with the idea for the book, and who were the writers and the works that inspired you?
Oh, gosh. I just really liked the idea of doing something that was novel and speculative and otherworldly, but set here. I thought it would be a fun topic to explore and to see what really literary authors would do with it. It's funny, when I think about books, what I was really inspired by wasn't books, to be honest. It was like my years as a child watching The Twilight Zone.
Ah, you know, yes.
And watching those old movies from the 50s with the monsters.
Oh, Godzilla,
and I
things like
that
monster
stuff.
Movies.
All that stuff, yeah. Yeah, I mean, books played into it, but more than that, one of the things I've been doing a lot of recently is listening to old radio shows from like the 1950s and 60s, and I've been listening to things that they're called like escape and suspense, you know,
right.
And they're fabulous, and they're all these, and they all come from old books. So, you know, in essence, I've read those books, right?
And a lot of them come from the old pulp magazines.
Yes.
In the 30s and 40s too. They adapted the stories for radio.
Totally, which I love, which is, you know, what I based all the graphics on in the book.
Oh, we'll talk about that a little later
about the
cover. The book's title, of course, City of Weird. How would you define weird?
It's interesting because I didn't realize when I started, when I pitched this book, that there was such a thing called weird fiction. Like, I didn't know that what I really loved.
Genre?
It's a genre, yeah. Pretty much everything you see in the book, you know, the monsters and the spacemen and the ghosts and all that, they're under this rubric. Is that the word? Rubric? Of weird fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What I was thinking when I started out, though, was let's take some sci-fi, some fantasy, some, you know, ghosts and all that, and let's make it really strange and, you know, play on the Portland weird theme and kind of mush them all together. Yeah, I had no idea that that was actually a real thing.
The stories are set in Portland because of our slogan, Keep Portland Weird. Is that the main reason?
They're set there because My first idea was to set a collection in Portland. That came before, I think, you know, the idea of doing it as quote-unquote weird fiction. And then I said, hey, it really works with our slogan, you know.
Yes. Yeah, and so. In fact, there's a great passage from one of the stories in the book. This one's called The Fixer, a Serial, by Sean Davis. And he says, and this is a quote, "Keep Portland weird, sure. It's our slogan, but most people's commitment to this idea consists of a $3 bumper sticker.
Yeah.
There's a weird here most don't have the slightest idea about. An otherworldliness only limited by how much you can take in. If you allow yourself to see it, to really see it, it's everywhere."
Yeah.
Do you see Portland in the same way as Sean Davis?
Yeah. I was that kid in high school who wore different colored socks on purpose and tried to be weird on purpose, and just moving here, you know, seeing that's free expression everywhere. I just loved it. And there are all kinds of weird here. You know, there's definitely that weird that comes on a bumper sticker, and, you know, the guy who plays the bagpipes, you know, dressed as Darth Vader and all that. But when you drill down to the individuals, everybody's got their kind of weird. Mm-hmm. And it just feels very free here, very...
You're free to be weird.
You're free to be weird. and it's not necessarily always an expression of, hey, look at me, you know. I think it's just a comfortableness that there is here.
Trying to be yourself.
Right, yeah.
The weird, we're using the term somewhat affectionately, or at the very least positively, as in Keep Portland Weird. However, it's often used as a derogatory term, meaning something different from us, the other.
Yeah.
If someone's from another culture or country, they're weird. If someone's gay or lesbian or transgender, they're weird. If something's different from what we're used to seeing or hearing, it's weird. Yeah. That definitely plays a big part in City of Weird Stories.
It sure does.
Was that something you sought out from the beginning? So the kind of the darker side of weird, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
No, I didn't think about that, actually. It was an idea of, hey, Portland, give me what you got. Let's see what Portland comes up with. And I was really surprised at how dark some of these went and how... You know, we'll talk to, like when we talked to Karen about her piece, that the sense of being other in not a positive way.
I think that's true with Dan's and Susie's piece too, in addition to Karen's.
Yeah,
I saw that in a lot of the stories in the collection.
Yeah, I was surprised by that because I was thinking about it in a slightly lighter way than some of the stories that I got. And I was very pleasantly surprised at how deep it went.
And to go even farther here, riffing on the term weird, there's a line, sometimes only a fine one, between the weird and the terrifying.
Yeah.
In the foreword to City of Weird, you write that one of the things you were looking for as you read through the submissions were, quote, I'm quoting from your foreword here, stories that exemplify what we're scared of now, at the turn of the 21st century, here in this kooky city known for its weirdness, just what freaks out tattooed unicycle riding hipsters anyway. So what freaks out those hipsters?
The thing that I found is that, I mean, I didn't talk to any hipsters, but the thing that I alluded to is that, you know, what freaks weirdos out is what freaks everybody out. And that's what I think sort of the book is all about. Like, what are we really scared of? Are we really scared of a giant octopus monster, or are we really scared of being alone? The real things, all of those things that we're afraid of.
And when you talked earlier about your love for those 50s monster movies and all that, you do mention in the foreword the fears in those days, of course, were atomic war.
Yeah.
So you had movies like Godzilla, you know, where monsters grew out of radiation. Yeah. Of course, there's fears that are more universal than that. So you said in the foreword that you're trying to figure out what is frightening people today and then using that in these horror stories or stories of the supernatural.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean... When you talk about fears that are, what are our big fears? What are our small fears? What are our particular fears? Maybe you can put atomic war in one camp and you can put shame in another camp. I think that all fears are just as, I mean, this kind of sounds silly. They're just as valid. You know, obviously they are. I just like the juxtaposition of a fear that's kind of ridiculous and a fear that's really, really true. And that was one of the things when a story did that really, you know, ding, that moved on to the next level. You know, I wanted that story.
Yeah, from reading all the stories, so all 30 stories, I saw at least two big fears that were playing out. kind of common theme that was going on in several of the stories. One's truly universal, and that's the fear of losing those we love. Mm-hmm. And those were often very touching and moving stories in the book, though almost you know, the kind that brings a little shiver to the back of your neck, and you know, ooh. And a lot of those are kind of ghost stories, that style. The other fear is not unique to Portland, but it's a big part of our lives here now, and that's the fear of displacement. And we'll get to Dan's story, which I think does quite a job on that, of being forced out of our homes, of our neighborhoods, our planet, in case of the story, and the fear we are powerless to do anything about it. Yeah. Did you have this in mind when selecting the stories, some of these big universal fears?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just... The fears that spoke to me, I was really obsessed with the earthquake thing. I just bought a house this last year as well, and the whole time that I was buying the house, I was thinking of buying a house in a place where the earthquake's going to come, we're going to all die or whatever, you know. I was very kind of obsessed with it, and that sense of powerlessness that we all have. A lot of my selections were just instinctive, like... what works for me? I don't know why this works for me. I don't know why this works for me. And then when I looked at it later, I saw that a lot of it was that powerless thing. And loneliness was a big thing in there, too.
Oh, definitely.
You know, again, to your first point about people
losing
being
people
lost.
You love.
Yeah, yeah. Who do we lose, and how do we lose ourselves, I guess, is what the bigger picture is in the book.
Gigi, I wondered, when you were looking for submissions, how'd you get the word out to Susie and to Dan and to Karen, people like that in the book? And what'd you tell the writers that you were looking for?
We put the word out through a number of publications, and we did a lot of just pushing things out on Facebook. I think that Portland is a very closely knit literary community, and it didn't take much doing to put the word out so that Portland writers knew what was going on, you know.
Through the grapevine kind of thing? Or you told one person who told another?
Through the Twitters and Facebooks, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and we would go and, you know, I would ask people, you know, specifically all three of these people. I was like, you know, will you please give me a story? There were a lot of people that I knew. I really liked their work. There were a lot of ways that we kind of set the fish line out or whatever.
Yeah, one more question for you before we get to Dan, and then we'll get to Karen and Susie in the studio here. The book contains 30 stories. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of them's a kind of a short comic. or graphic tale, I guess, is the preferred nomenclature. It's organized into 8 sections, from the deep, from the skies, to the dogs, in the books of the dead, of the undead, into the weird and no return. Mm. Did you collect the stories first and then organize the book into its current sections, or vice versa? Did the sections start first?
I collected the stories and started going through them and said, okay, how do I want to organize the book? And I had a few different possible arrangements that I talked to Laura, the publisher, about. One of them, I had this idea at one point that I could maybe see if I could find one little element in each story to connect number one story with number two story. Then there would be something from number two story to connect to number three story. Well, like, for instance, Dan's story has, you know, a character named Pod in it. There's a story that comes right before his in the book that is about a... pod of orcas. And so there's a pod here, and then that's a pod there.
I didn't catch that connection.
Tried that, and then that's as far as it went, actually.
Of course, the one after his is the comic tale, and that's also about planetary invasion.
Connection there,
a definite connection.
That fell apart. But what happened really was that I got a lot of stories about books, and I was really surprised at how many stories I got about books. Karen's is one of them, and we'll talk about that. And I said, that's a little strange, you know. Number one, it's a little strange to have so, you know, I was trying to get as many different types of stories as I could. And here I had this bunch of stories about one thing. So I said, I'm going to make sections, you know. Because I had most of the monsters are aquatic. I don't know why. Don't ask me why. Most of the monsters are in the water. And so I was able to kind of put them into to little sections. And
some of them seems like they could have fit in more than one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, many of them did. I had a lot. Oh, I could put this story here, I could put it over here, you know.
Yeah, there was one towards the end of the Undead where a guy's friend falls into the Columbia River and drowns but comes back. But somewhat as a sea creature, so he could have gone in the first section of the book, too.
And you know what happened?
Oh, what's that?
When we made the actual book, we changed it. It's now in the first section.
Oh, it is? Yeah. Oh, okay. I have the advanced copy.
The advanced copy. That's the one change we made for the order. Yeah.
Okay, I'll make that correction in my copy.
So he must have heard you.
Right. Telepathically. Yeah. My supernatural powers.
Yes. Yeah.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Gigi Little, Dan DeWeese, Karen Monroe, and Susie Vitello about the new collection of short fiction, City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales from Forest Avenue Press. Gigi, again, thanks for bringing Dan, Karen, and Susie with you. Dan DeWeese, I'd like to start with you on your story. It was called Transformation, and it's in the From the Sky section. It's on the surface about an H.G. Wells-type alien invasion, narrated by a character aptly named Pod. Gigi mentioned that, who transports slime molds to the new planet. So just this pure pulpy sci-fi, and yet there's a lot going on there that you must have had in mind. I got colonialization, gentrification, a lot of issues that I think we're facing in Portland across the whole country.
Yeah, I think the way that I tried to hope that the material would have more than one thing going on, or that there'd be more than one way to read it, was to actually just concentrate on writing about slime molds. I mean, the more that you wrote about slime molds from outer space trying to take over our planet, or in the scope of the story, our city, if you could be kind of faithful to slime molds and what they would be trying to do and what their conflicts would be, it seemed to me like that naturally led to other thoughts a reader could have, which I wouldn't need to plan in any way.
And yet you had that conversation there between I would call the main character Pod, who's transporting the slime molds. And then there's one kind of, not necessarily rebellious, but a questioning slime mold named Red, but he prefers to be called by his real name, Sheckley. How'd you come up with that? That's really a big part of the theme of the story.
Yeah, the story is really about the one slime mold who eventually decides that taking over someone else's planet is just as boring as anything else that anyone would do. You know, he says there's a certain point in the story where he asks to be called Sheckley. There was a science fiction writer
Robert Sheckley.
Yeah, Robert Sheckley. Yeah. So,
50s.
I really admire a lot of his stories and his ability to have a lot, especially short stories, to move into a lot of different material in the space of a short number of pages. And he was kind of a master of the conflicted alien story. So there was a point where I realized that the slime mold wouldn't want to just be called what color he is. There's something kind of generic about that. But he should ask to be called by a certain name. So I just dropped that in there.
It humanizes him, if humanize is the right word. It certainly gives him a personality, a Sheckley, where Red is just kind of generic.
Yeah, Red is just what he looks like from the outside. So there's a point in the story where he has to be called something else. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Robert Sheckley. Then did you use as your model some of those classic sci-fi stories of the 40s and 50s?
I had been reading him a lot when Gigi had sent out the call for stories. And so it seemed like, and that was just a coincidence, it seemed like an opportunity to kind of look at the kind of things I really admired about his writing. I don't normally write stories about slime molds, but but when I heard about this opportunity to write a science fiction or a horror story of some kind, because I'd been reading Sheckley, I automatically thought, okay, this is a chance to try and see if I can do something somewhat similar to what he was able to do.
I thought it was a masterful way of kind of updating the pulp sci-fi story, and yet there was so much to it, which I think was true of a lot of stories in the book. If I could say, Gigi is just, it's working on what you had mentioned, Dan, it's working on several levels. I don't think there's a story in the book that's not. So it's working on a very visceral level where it's just entertaining as pulpy sci-fi, horror, supernatural, and yet there's a lot going on under the surface. Karen, I'd like to get to your story next, and it's called called The Color Off the Shelf, and it's in the books section. This is what Gigi mentioned about stories about magic books and bookstores, and yours takes place in Powell's. In fact, after reading your story, I don't think I'll ever be able to go into Powell's again and not look for that secret door leading down to the the mysterious basement room. How'd you come up with that?
I mean, it sort of seems like there should be a mysterious secret basement room in Powell's, doesn't it? It's like, isn't there? I mean, I don't work there, but Gigi does.
I'm not telling.
Oh, okay. It's got to be, right? If you've ever been in the parking garage in that store, you know that's an old building and there's probably some secrets.
And in your story, the secret room is found by a black male, young black male is working on his PhD dissertation. He's looking for this book that he can't find anywhere else. Could you just give us a little about the story without giving too much away?
Gosh, sure, yeah. So the book he's looking for is a work of what we would now probably call pseudo-scientific racism, or scientific racism, I guess, is what some folks think of it as. Anyway, it's the 19th century sort of historical anthropology that used sort of artificial scientific rationale for justifying racism, racist beliefs about different groups of folks. It had, you probably are familiar with some of those sort of hijinks that went on with head measuring and, you know, facial analysis and so on in these efforts that people were making to justify racist beliefs about different groups of people. It was a big deal for white folks in the mid-19th century. We were really into that.
There's a particular horror writer, actually one of the most famous American horror writers, H.P. Lovecraft, who unfortunately was a racist, an anti-Semite. He wrote a poem that I looked up, researched after your story, that I can't even say on the air. I'd rather not. Mm-hmm. But it uses a word there that is not used too frequently anymore, fortunately. Did you have that in mind when you wrote the story, H.P. Lovecraft's background?
Yeah, absolutely. So when Gigi sent out the call for me, the weird call kind of for me didn't go so much to the pulp era as it did go to the weird literature of Lovecraft. And Lovecraft seems to me really, really central to the whole idea of weird literature, and also really problematic, really influential and extremely problematic for all those reasons that you just mentioned. Very complicated person and a complicated writer. And I think there's a whole legacy of people, particularly in science fiction, horror, you know, genre literature, trying to grapple with his heritage as someone who was so important for everyone from Stephen King to, you know, Robert Bloch to Robert Howard and all these folks who are important writers in the field. But also, you know, they just recently took his face off of the, I think it's the World Fantasy Award, or is it the Hugo? I don't remember which it is now.
Oh, but I didn't know that.
One of the statuettes that's awarded for one of the major genre awards has for years been Lovecraft's face, and it was recently redesigned, which I think is a good thing because he's so problematic. Because from my point of view, at least, racial resentment was and fear were just at the core of his notion of horror and literature.
In fact, Portland still has an H.P. Lovecraft festival, a film festival, I think, at the Hollywood Theater every year.
And a bar, yeah, as well. Yeah, I mean, he's still celebrated widely. And obviously, you know, it's complicated. It's not to say that if you enjoy Lovecraft, you're automatically an uncomplicated racist person. But I think folks are grappling with it a lot. And I would actually, if I could, really recommend, there's a writer, Victor Laval, who is...
I read about his book, yes. It came out earlier in the year.
Just this past year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he had a book that came out that I would highly recommend. It's a short book called The Ballad of Black Tom, which is in direct conversation with Lovecraft and his legacy. And Victor is a black writer of science fiction and fantasy and horror. And if you're interested in those and you want to see somebody kind of going head to head with Lovecraft, I would say that's an amazing book to track down.
Well, I would also recommend your story, too, to those same readers. Susie Vitello, your story, The Deflowering, which is in the section of the undead, as well, is supernatural on the surface and funny, but there's a lot going on there, as with Dan's stories and Karen's story. Can you set it up a little bit for us so the listener kind of knows what we're talking about, but
sure.
Again, not giving too much away?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Ken. Thanks. So I guess I was kind of interested in, for the last few years, I've been writing YA, young adult, and I'm kind of been in that headspace a little bit. But what's fascinating to me, as I've been a parent for the last 30 years, is a sort of interplay between parental anxiety and loss of innocence. And I think, you know, this was a great opportunity to kind of play with that in a rather playful but also dark way. And I suppose the origin of the place I chose to set the story, where the magic happens, is actually the little house on the Hawthorne Bridge that goes up and down.
I'll never look at the Hawthorne Bridge the same again either every time I cross it.
Yeah. And that, I guess, speaks directly to parental anxiety, because years ago, I was going through this divorce, and my youngest child was at the time maybe 3 or 4. And my ex-husband would, you know, take him for these sort of over-the-top adventures when it was his turn to parent. And one of these over-the-top adventures was he knew the guy that went up and down in that you know, bridge lift. And apparently at midnight, every midnight, that goes up and down.
Because
it's a regulation.
I thought you made that up.
This is what the ex told me. So maybe I didn't, you know, maybe it's not true. But
it led to a great story, though. Yeah.
But apparently there's a rule that, you know, a guy has to make sure that it works, right? And so he knew my ex, and he said, why don't you bring your little boy, you know, at midnight and go up and down. So that's kind of why I said it there.
And you had three teenage girls in there, very close friends. They call themselves the triplets. And you use hashtag there in social media, which they would do. Mm-hmm. One of them is narrating it. The friends are Wispy, Fuchsia, and the narrator's Emily. Mm-hmm. They're all about to turn 16. And the fathers pay for this service, which is very funny, a sweet 16, S-U-I-T-E. And basically from there, the story becomes somewhat of what you're saying, the kind of a parent-child conflict. It seems like we have this Keep Portland Weird, and yet parents really don't want their kids to grow up that way.
Right.
And I think the story kind of captures that beautifully.
Thank you. That's
what you were trying to do, I would imagine.
That was one of the things in there, you know. And, you know, also the idea of bicycle memorials and roses, you know, are in there too, a little metaphorically.
Yeah, City of Roses.
Yeah.
Gigi, I should mention that you not only edited City of Weird and all these great stories, including Dan's, Karen's, and Susie's, which you just talked about, but you designed the cover as well. And it's very striking. Beautiful cover.
Oh, thank you.
Could you describe the cover to our listeners? This is radio, so there's no way of showing the picture, unfortunately, and what you had in mind.
Well, it is an octopus monster, giant octopus on the Hawthorne Bridge?
Is it Broadway?
Which bridge? It's the Broadway Bridge.
I looked up the images, and it was closest to the Broadway Bridge.
Yeah, yeah. And with some, you know, Portland in the background. It's based on those lovely old Weird Tales, Amazing Stories magazine covers.
Captures it perfectly. It looks like one of those pulp magazines of the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, I just, you know, I couldn't wait to... That's half the reason I pitched the book, I think, in the first place. I could do that.
just so it have that cover there.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's my main job at Forest Avenue Press, which is the publisher that did the book. Yeah, so I'm enamored of those, and it was sort of in my head the whole time, yeah.
Best bookstore to buy it, of course, is Powell's.
I'm not going to say that.
Okay.
There's lots of lovely bookstores out there, even though I work at Powell's.
Go down to that secret room and...
Go down to the secret room, yes.
If it attaches itself to you and you can't get rid of it.
Yes. That's what I hope this book does to you, attaches itself to you and you can't get rid of it.
In a good way.
Not in
an H.P. Lovecraft way.
Right.
Well, Gigi, Karen, Susie, Dan, thanks very much for coming into KBOO. It was a pleasure talking with you all about the book City of Weird.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Gigi Little, Dan DeWeese, Karen Monroe, and Susie Vitello about the new collection of short fiction, City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales from Forest Avenue Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Gigi, Dan, Karen, and Susie for joining us at KBOO, and for all of you for listening.
You'd better watch out for the eggplant that ate Chicago. If he's still hungry, the whole country's doomed.
Well, it's in trouble.
If he's still hungry, the whole country's doomed. Whack-a-doo, whack-a-doo.